Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. In our last episode, we spoke about children and families experiencing homelessness, learning how a family might become homeless, and what they're likely to experience in a shelter. Today, we're going to look at this problem from a different lens, coming to understand the vital importance of early educational experiences for these and other vulnerable young children. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, early childhood experiences from birth to age 8 affect the development of the brain's architecture, which provides the foundation for future learning, behavior, and health. A strong foundation helps children develop the skills they need to become well-functioning adults. When brain development in infants and young children is fully supported, they're more likely to reach milestones critical to future individual and community success, including third grade reading proficiency, high school graduation and post-secondary education, gainful employment, lifetime physical and mental health, and avoidance of substance use disorder and crime. Doctors McCoy and Yoshikawa et al. From Harvard University researched the role of early childhood education in supporting positive outcomes in later life. They found that classroom-based early education programs for children under the age of 5 can lead to significant and substantial decreases in special education placement and grade retention, and increases in high school graduation rates. Significantly, none of these studies specifically address vulnerable children, such as those experiencing homelessness and are involved in the child welfare system due to abuse or neglect. What is the value of early childhood education for these children? Today, we have the honor of speaking with Pamela Austin, MSW and Executive Director of Children Today. Children Today is a nonprofit organization that provides trauma-informed child development daycare and preschool to children aged 6 weeks through 5 years of age and their families. Notably, the children of Children Today are experiencing homelessness and or maltreatment, such as child abuse, with an open case with the Department of Children and Family Services. Welcome, Pamela. Thank you for joining us today. I'm very familiar with your organization, but we just met this morning, just now. So for my benefit and the benefit of our listeners, will you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I'm a social worker. I'm an MSW. I'm proud to say that.
Social workers rule.
They do. It's one of those things that I've always felt like no matter what I'm doing, I'm a social worker. I've had friends say, oh, you're not. You're the ED or you're a CEO. And I'm like, no. Or a consultant. I'm saying, no, I happen to be a social worker who's doing consulting, or I'm a social worker who's running an agency, but I lead with that. I think it's really important. I've been doing it for 35 years now. It's like, dang, it's a long time. And my background's been mostly in healthcare and social services. So coming into early childhood education, while I've been on committees in Orange County and, been on the peripheral of that, and I've certainly worked with small children, this was kind of new. So when I first came in, I was kind of looking at things going, first of all, I had a really strong organization. They were financially sound. Our associate director, Elia, had been doing a great job. You know, she had been the interim director for about 18 months. So I kind of thought, well, do you really need me? Because I'm usually used to going in and fixing things when it comes to kind of like the infrastructure. And she's like, oh, no, we really need you. And but it's out there with the kids and stuff. So I think my background was, it was kind of fun to really be able to be a social worker in the most basic sense, which is really looking at, you know, starting where the client's at. And my clients happen to be our teachers and our families that we serve, and being able to look at it from that lens. What are the strengths? What's going on? So if we are having children that were dysregulated, we could look at behavior observations, things like that. So I think my background in what I learned as a social worker was really helpful. And I have been a consultant. Usually I work in strategic planning and program development, program evaluation. So I've done that. And again, mostly in the healthcare field. So I've done things for UCI, the university, and Cal State Fullerton and Cal Optima. And I also ran a community clinic, which its main focus was behavioral health. So I ran the Gary Center in La Habra, and then eventually walked them through a merger with a large FQHC clinic. So there we must serve, I think our population is around 10,000 a year that we served. And I had a lot of students from all the local universities. So I had a lot of experience with interns and with mental health and families. And we also had a population of, we had a full service food pantry. So we really provided other social supports for those families. So I think all those kinds of experiences have been helpful. And I did get about halfway through my clinical hours. I did about 1,700 hours out in Riverside, and then went back into management and never got them finished. Now I'd have to start all over again.
Well, but that wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be a great retirement goal. I'll do it once I retire.
And then start seeing clients. Nice.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I was doing that, I did a lot of in-home family evaluations. We did consultations to early childhood programs, pre-K, kindergarten. So all those kinds of experiences were really helpful coming into this.
Yeah, I could see where those experiences would feed very nicely into what into children today and the families that you serve there. So that's a nice segue if you could tell us a little bit about your organization and what
you
do.
We just celebrated our 25th anniversary last year. And we initially started as a drop-in center for homeless families. Our founders, which were Teresa Bixby and Jennifer Fitzgerald, were good friends. And I think Jennifer was in early childhood education, and they just started observing and realizing in the community they would see children that had no place to go amongst the homeless population. And so they developed us originally as just a drop-in center so that families could have a place for their child to be safe and play while they, you know, process paperwork or went to, you know, trainings or things that were helping them get back on their feet. In a very short order, they really realized that they needed to be a full service early childhood provider. And so that's what they focused on. They had two locations in downtown area of Long Beach. And then in 2015, 2016, they did a capital campaign and we're now at Long Beach and Spring Street. And we have one location. And our population is basically homeless families who are currently homeless, going through the process, they're insecurely housed, something like that. Shelters, we get a lot of referrals from the domestic shelters. And then we also serve foster children, children who have already been placed in foster care. And we actually kind of have a small network of foster families that as they've used us, they get new kids coming to them and then they'll tell their social worker, please refer you know, two children today. So that's where we want to place our kids when we're taking care of them. And then finally, we're a Head Start partner. So we also take Head Start and early Head Start children. So that's our three populations. And it has to be on a referral basis. You don't just come to us. It's really, you can self-refer. So if you heard about us and you are in that homeless situation, then you can self-refer. If you've heard of us and you're part of Head Start, then they can refer to us. And again, if you have a child in foster care, then we can tell you to have your social worker refer to us.
Gotcha.
And all our services are free. There's no charge for our services.
So, you know, it's safe to say that we're all aware of the homelessness crisis across California. You can't not be aware of it. It's so bad. But I do think it's still hard for many to imagine that we have small children who are homeless. And I know that you serve from newborns
6 weeks
up to the kindergarten, up to kindergarten age. And can you speak to that? Like, are there, of course, I mean, I know the answer to this, but let's talk about how are there really homeless families? We're talking about babies.
Yeah. Of course. I want to say of course, because what would exclude them, right? They're often young, low income, essential workers, you know, so losing a job can really, you know, put them at risk. They're really living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, and then you lose a paycheck and then you lose your home. So it's not surprising at all. It's just sad that that's the situation. Not everybody has extended family. So, you know, many people who are struggling might be able to reach out to parents or siblings or, you know, some kind of relative or close friend, but not everyone has that. And so then they're kind of stuck in that situation, or you have young parents and maybe there's a domestic violence situation. And so the mother needs to get someplace safe with her children. And so that's where we get referrals from the shelters to, you know, we've had a number of families that recently we had a mom that was leaving us after she'd been with us with her two children for a number of years. She'd gotten her training and her work and still had her job that she got. And one of the things she said to us, and she was crying because she was going to be missing us as she's moving them into kindergarten. Right. So our last one was leaving us. And she goes, it was such a relief to know my children were safe during the day while I was going into training and getting this job. And she made me cry. It was just, you could feel that emotion that it was just such a godsend to her that we were there for her and that she knew her children were physically and emotionally safe during the day.
Well, sure. I mean, hard enough to be homeless, right? But how do you get back on your feet and do the things you need to do to become self-sufficient again if you have kids? Because you can't leave them in the encampment or in your car. So I can just see how vital that is.
It becomes a downward spiral that it's like you didn't necessarily do anything wrong. You know, it's just one circumstance in life can push you into that downward spiral, and then it's hard to get out of it.
Right. Absolutely. And now you said that not all your children are homeless. Some come to you because they're involved with the system, with Child Protective Services. What kind of abuse or neglect do you see? Like what are a typical history that you see among those children?
Well, first of all, we don't get that history, right? They're entitled to their privacy. So, what a foster parent may know, they can share with us, but even they don't necessarily get a lot of information. But I know from statistics that the number one reason that children end up in foster care systems is neglect. That's really the biggest reason. People often think it's, you know, physical abuse. That's a part of it, but neglect's the number one thing. So what I see with children when I'm looking at them is just this sense of lack of stability. It's traumatic to go. I don't see like foster children and homeless children all that differently in the sense of they've lost their home. They've lost their base of origin. And so that's similar. And so that trauma of losing that stability is the same for both. It can be more complex when you're with a foster family and you're creating a bond and then you are visiting your parent, which is not a bad thing. It just is it's hard for a child to maneuver that. So they may go and do monitor visits, or they may eventually, if they're trying to do reunification, they eventually get overnight visits. And then we see those behaviors that come back in as they're dysregulated. And again, it's not that that's not a good thing for them to do. It's just hard for them to maneuver. So, sure. We, you know, you will see a lot of like when you make a transition. For us, a transition could be coming in the morning. It can be going from inside to outside for play. It can be a transition from one activity to another. And those changes, those what may seem to us as adults such a simple thing, it's just a routine, you know, going from one to the other, it can be very dysregulating for some of the children. So one of our emphases is the routine, that they do the same thing, same kinds of things. So they'll have, you know, we do breakfast, lunch, and snack. So they'll come in and they get checked in and they do some play and they know that that's what's going to happen. And then they're going to get breakfast at the same time. And, you know, even doing that, it's like, okay, we wash our hands first, then we sit at the table. And if you get out of sync at all in those routines, they'll remind you, no, that's not what we do. This is what we do first. But that creates this sense of stability and predictability. Both children that are homeless and those who are in the DCSF system have already experienced life is not predictable. It's not something you can trust. They know that. It's not, you know, it's not an unrealistic knowledge that they have. It's real for them. So when they can come and see the same teachers and have the same routine each day, and know everybody and go from one, that starts over time to help them start to feel safe.
So talk a little bit about, and you have touched on it, but I maybe dig a little bit deeper if we could. You know, I can see if you have a homeless baby or a homeless toddler, and I can see where the respite is incredibly helpful for the parent to try to get restabilized. But how does early childhood development education really help the kids? Obtaining housing or sending them to therapy, I think it's easy for people to understand how that might help. How does preschool or child development services, how do they help these kids?
Well, first of all, it helps all children. So we should point that out, that it's good for all children. But for our kids, especially because it is the consistency and the safety and the stability that we start to build that basis of them being able to trust adults, that people will be kind to them and care for them. This is the basis for any learning that happens after that. You know, if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you don't feel safe, you don't have food, you don't have shelter, nothing else can happen. So for this very young age, when they're developing everything from their fine and motor skills, their gross motor skills, language acquisition, it's very much dependent on the relationships around them. Children learn through interaction, through play, through people talking with them, not at them. It's very important that our teachers also in that predictability, and so that they can feel safe in the world and like they have some control over it, is like, we're going to get in line now. You know, our child's upset, would you like a hug? Or I'm going to pick you up now to move you over here. We tell them what's going on before it happens. Nothing's more disturbing to a child than if someone just kind of grabs them, you know, but all of that is part of the learning process. We want them to be able to be healthy, happy, social human beings, knowing how to interact in the world, understanding others' feelings, understanding their own feelings and being able to control them, and eventually be able, you know, as they gain language, communicate about what their needs are. Nothing's sweeter than to seeing, especially in the toddler preschool classroom, is, you know, we help them feel their heartbeat, do the breathing, and to see another child help a child do that. It's just like they'll sit there, put their hand on their shoulder and say, just breathe. It's okay. And it's like they're learning how to interact in the world and perceive others' needs and know that they have the strength to be able to reach out and do something about it. So in learning anything moving forward, they're going to be more stabilized, be able to learn language and do their math and interact in a classroom when they have to get into that environment.
Well, that's going to help them interact in the world. I love that story you just told, because that's basic socio-emotional learning. You're not only teaching that child how to regulate their own emotion, you're teaching them empathy. Like if for a child to reach out and help another one that way, that's teaching empathy. And I just think that's lovely.
And recognizing others, you know, and knowing how to share and how to ask for what they want. And, all of that, you know, we've seen lots of data where saying the most successful adults are those who are socially emotionally balanced, more so than those who did really well academically. That in the real world, you really have to be able to interact with other human beings and understand your interactions and the cooperation that's necessary to really be successful. And that starts for everyone pretty much in preschool.
Well, and I would imagine it's, you know, a mother who is homeless, it's going to be very difficult. How does she have the bandwidth to teach those things to her toddler? So that's where just these services are so much more important for your population than even for the general population.
Yeah, we're moving them from survival mode to being able to actually flourish and make friends. You know, it's wonderful to see them make their best friends and share that with one another.
So I read on your website that each child is assigned a primary caregiver when they come to the program. And I just loved that so much. But could you please explain for our listeners what that is and why it matters?
Yeah. And first of all, it's not like each child gets an individual one.
Right. Of course.
We don't have that many
a
teachers.
One-to-one ratio.
Yeah. We do have very low ratios, much lower than licensing requires, because we understand the needs of our children. So we'll assign teachers, like, you know, say in our preschool, they may have four children per teacher. That's their responsibility. But we also observe to see how a child chooses. So once they get comfortable, they'll choose someone we refer to, oh, that's their person. And so we may make that switch. You know, they're still in the same classroom in the same physical environment, but it may be like, oh, okay, so you'll take this one and this child will, because they've chosen you. And so they're responsible for them. They build that relationship with them. It's their teacher. And so that's very important. And sometimes a child will pick someone out of the blue. So we had an infant, he's now in toddlers, but I go into the classroom, but I'm not in there very often. You know, I just come in to check on things, whatever. I walked into the infant room and he was crawling at this point, took one look at me, crawled over as fast as he could. And from that point on, I was his person. And the teachers thought it was hysterical because he just chose me and we don't know why. But every time I would come in, he would come over to me. He wanted me to pick him up. And even now he's on the playground and he's playing, but he'll stop whatever he's doing, run over, give me a hug, and then go back to it.
That just sounds like the greatest thing to have happen at work.
It was, you know, quite the thing. But that what that shows you, though, is the children pick for whatever reason. It could be how someone looks. It could be the sound of their voice. It's just, you know, they might be reminding them of someone that feels safe for them. And so we're very aware of that. We make sure we accommodate that as best we can.
According to the Children's Law Center of California, 100 children in our state are placed into foster care every day. In 2020, Los Angeles County had nearly 117,000 referrals to the child welfare system for alleged child abuse, domestic violence, parental substance abuse, and/or child neglect. Of these, almost 40,000 resulted in cases being opened with the Department of Children and Family Services. We know that children involved in the welfare system, especially foster care, have worse outcomes than children who do not experience abuse. According to the National Working Group on Foster Care and Education, intervening early in the lives of young children impacted by abuse and neglect is critical. Almost one-third of children in the child welfare system are under the age of 5. Not only are the numbers of infants and young children concerning, their vulnerability is extremely high. Their researchers found a consistently high need for early intervention and early childhood education services among young children in the child welfare system as a result of their developmental, emotional, and behavioral problems. Fortunately, data suggests that there are effective early interventions to help these vulnerable children be prepared when they enter kindergarten. You and I, Pamela, we're social workers. We understand that behavior is communication, especially in kids and especially in really little ones like you have. Do you see behaviors in your children that worry you? Like what sorts of emotional, behavioral, developmental, or even physical impacts might you see in your children?
Okay. First of all, as a social worker, I always tell people that if I don't see behaviors, then I'm concerned. Just to say, you know. That said, there are certain behaviors that really will draw your attention and make sure you're aware. So if a child does any self-harm and you say, well, why would a little one like that do that? But you might have a child who will bang their head against a wall or try to on the ground because they're frustrated or upset, or you know, sometimes you can't even tell what caused that. So obviously we want to protect them from harming themselves, but we also, you know, have conversations with the parent or the foster parent to say, are you seeing this at home? What else is going on? There are times when we make sure that there's a referral to a behavioral health specialist that can work with that child. We will see behaviors just because the child lacks language. And we do say that I think speech is the number one request period for all children in early education and kindergarten. But I think we see a lot of that and trying to make sure they, you know, we help and support their language development. But when they know that what they want to say, they understand, but they can't find the words or they don't have the words yet, they'll get frustrated and you'll see maybe some hitting or throwing something or a temper tantrum. And that's frustration. And so we just try to calm them and try to find some way. So we'll use some sign language while we use words as well. We respond to pointing, you know, but use the language like, you know, if you're pointing to a cup. So it's like you would like a cup, you would like a drink, and you try to build their language, but you want to, you know, again, kind of the social work perspective, you respond to what they're able to do and then you build on that. But those, you will have temper tantrums. I don't see it as much as I used to, but we still get it occasionally where a child can go in a meltdown, which is different than a temper tantrum. Temper tantrums, I'm just mad and went, you know, it blows off pretty quickly. But a meltdown is once they start to spiral. I've seen a child just scream and cry for like an hour. And that's not good. I mean, it's not good for anyone, but it's really, the child can't seem to get out of it. They can't, you know, they're having trouble regulating, and we'll switch up teachers when that's happening. So I have a system in place where if a child's into a meltdown, that a teacher won't stay with them more than 15 minutes because I don't want that teacher to get overwhelmed. And often if you substitute in another teacher, and again, someone they know, it's not strangers, they're all in the same classroom, often that disrupts it as well because they're like, wait a minute, you're not the person I want to yell at. But we watch for those kinds of things, try to ascertain, is there something going on at home? Often we might find that they did a visit for the first time with a parent, or there's a primary person in the home that's no longer there. So say grandma isn't there anymore for whatever reason. And when we have those conversations, it's kind of interesting because parents at first, we take things so much in stride, right? We get overwhelmed with everything we have to do, that even when something is stressful, we almost don't acknowledge it for ourselves. You know, we just keep going. We just got to keep going. So we don't always recognize when it's impacting the child. And so sometimes when we have those conversations and like, are you sure there's nothing different going on? Oh no. And so, and then you'll say, well, their uncle moved out. It's like, yeah, okay, that explains it. And they're like, oh, it's like, yeah, they're missing them. Or that's just a, you know, difference. Or grandma's gone, or they went home for a weekend overnight visit. Not that anything went wrong with the visit. It's just not the routine. Now they have this sense of like, well, that's mom and I want to be with mom. But then you go back home to foster home and they're great. You know, it's just very dysregulating. So being able to watch those behaviors and give those emotional supports, not just to the child, but to the care provider, whether that's mom or whether it's a foster parent, and helping them. And then we have conversations about what works for you at home when they're doing that. It may be that something we can duplicate, or sometimes they ask us, what are you doing? Because it seems to be better at school. So that communication and support, it really is that community that helps that child.
What does it mean? I mean, I'm hearing a lot of it in what you're saying, but for our listeners, what does it mean when you say that your classrooms are trauma-informed?
I love that term because
love you know, it.
Well, I love it in the sense that it's very ambiguous. So even in my interview process, they asked me about, you know, trauma-informed. I said, well, there's no real definition of that. And so we will have to decide that for ourselves. What does that mean for our services and our families? And so as we look at that, it's really becoming, you know, trauma-informed just means you're aware that the child has trauma in their background. But how does that impact what you do with them? Being informed is not sufficient. It's really like what happens after that. And for us, sometimes it's also just understanding a child will take longer to acclimate when they come into a classroom. Many of my teachers are so dedicated to what they're doing. They just want to help in every way they can, that sometimes they feel frustrated with themselves. Like, I'm not able to get this child to really, you know, blend in and feel happy here. And it's like, give them time. Whatever they've gone through, this is their pace. And it's okay. It's not reflective on you. You just continue to be there. And that really helps and supports the teachers because they want to do such a good job for our kids. But you know, understanding that, you know, every child's different. Good examples, I had a set of twins that came to us. They were 15 months old. They had already been in 3 foster homes by the time they came to us. And here they're identical twins, but they didn't behave identically when they came. One cried all the time. The other one just like, I'll go play over here now. So it was really interesting to see that they, you know, were together the whole time, but they were handling it differently. And so we just realized that other twin, the one that was struggling, needed just maybe a few more hugs, gave him time, didn't need to push him into playing, just let him be and feel safe. And eventually, you know, he caught up with his brother and, you know, was able to play and have fun and enjoy things. But we have, you know, again, you have to start where the client's at. You have to start where the child's at. You can't push them beyond where they're capable. They have to learn. They've already learned that they can't trust anybody. They've already learned that the world's not a safe and predictable place. And that's real for them. So we, you know, come to us and say, no, no, you're going to be safe. It's going to be fun. We've got, it's like,
trust us.
Yes. So it's part of that trauma-informed is also being respectful of their own boundaries. That's why we ask before we pick up or touch or we inform them, you know, especially if you're changing, even babies, if you're changing diapers, you talk to them and tell them what you're doing as you're doing it. We try to give warnings. So in the sense of in 5 minutes, we're going to put these things away. And then, you know, and then in 3 minutes, we're going to get ready. So it's not abrupt. So they know what's coming. So it becomes predictable, because the lack of predictability, security, and control is what they've experienced. And that is absolutely frightening. That's frightening to adults. It's definitely frightening to children.
you know, school ends and then and these children return to their caregivers. What supports do those caregivers need to better support them? And what services are you able to offer them?
Okay, so we do a lot of referrals. So it could be referrals for, we have a good network, right? Long Beach has a lot of services. And so we do connect with all of them. So if they need help with housing, then we make sure that they've gotten that connection. If there's food, you know, insecurities, then one of the things we do is we have one of our board members who is part of the community action program. And so there's food resources that we're able to give. We also have at the end of the day, so we cook on campus at the center, and she always makes little leftovers and those are ready to go. So if families want to pick that up on their way out and have dinner that night with the food that we've cooked, we make sure that's available. During the holidays, we have a, we call it a holiday store. Nobody's buying anything. And we have wonderful supporters, including our board members and the community as a whole and people they know. And we get donations of toys and clothing. And we have one woman who knits all year long, sweaters and scarves and hats and blankets. And I'm sure she's knitting as we're speaking. And she brings those. And so we set that up and we make sure the entire family has access. So if they have a teen, there'll still be items that they can choose from. And then we also will give any, like this last year, we did gas cards and grocery cards in addition to those items. And it'll be based on family size and income. And so they get that little envelope on their way out as they got their toys. So we're there for them all the time. I mean, our primary focus is to provide early childhood education and childcare. But we make those connections in the community where we can. And a good example is we had a mom that had just been approved for her HUD housing. She had a place. She was very excited. And then she was talking to our center director, Alexis, who's wonderful with connecting the community. And she said, I guess I'm not going to get this home because the landlord wants more money. And Alexis said, oh, no, that does not happen. That's not legal. And she quickly connected her to somebody over at HUD who she knew. And next thing you know, she's in that home. But if she hadn't had that relationship with Alexis, and she didn't know that she had any recourse. And right. Here was somebody trying to take advantage of that.
So those partnerships are really important.
Extremely
then.
Important. It's how our families come to us, but it's also how we can connect them to other services they might not be aware of, including, you know, relationships and referrals to regional center, Harbor Regional Center, Buffum School, which has, services for, you know, special needs children. We make those connections. We call them our Head Start partnerships, very important to us. They're able to provide us additional services and referrals for our children. So it's very important.
You know, I know this as a clinician, it can sometimes be very hard to work with a parent, you know, has been abusive or neglectful of a child. How do your teachers navigate that?
Well, first of all, we do a lot of training because it's always difficult to deal with parents, period. Again, I don't want to overemphasize that, those situations. Many times we're probably not seeing the parent directly if the child's in the DCSF system, but we still interact with them somewhat because they may have educational rights. And so if we have to make a referral, we have to get that approval. We're not there to judge. We're there to support. In our trainings, we've done trainings on how to have difficult conversations, how to look at parents' family strengths and not look at our biases. As a social worker, when we go through our training, the first thing they want you to learn is what pushes your buttons, what's going to cause that counter transference. It's not good if you don't have something, because then you're not being totally truthful. And so that's what I teach my teachers. It's really about, it's not that I tell you can't have those biases or that you can't have those feelings. You just can't let them color what you're doing. It can't come into your voice, into your language, into the, you know, your eye contact with them. That needs to be set aside. Your primary goal is to make sure that that child is supported by all parties, the mother, the foster parent, the teachers, the therapists. And that means communication to really say what's in the best interest of the child. What do we do need, you know, here? So I would say my teachers do a pretty good job. And we always keep that conversation open. It's never a done deal. You know, we did a whole thing on temperament, the training that I put together. And then we had the teachers actually do an assessment of their temperament, and they were asked to pick a child in under their care and do their assessment. Then we came back the next training and had them report back. And it was so cute in some ways. So I remember one teacher saying, "Oh my God, I have the same temperament as this child. No wonder, wonder he, you know, pushes my buttons." But that was wonderful for them to understand, you know, and that temperament plays into how they're going to interact. So sure. Same thing with our parents, really understanding they're going to maybe feel defensive. Maybe they don't trust anyone because they don't have a reason to. And so that may take longer, but our goal is to build that trust, answer their questions, try to make gentle suggestions that don't sound like, "Oh, you're doing it wrong." More like, "This is what I'm trying. You know, maybe you could try it. Maybe it'll work at home too." And always ask, "What is it you're doing that might work that could help me?" Now you're in a partnership with them. It's not somebody who telling them, "I know it better than you."
Right.
Because they may be with us anywhere from 6 to 8 hours a day. We are not their parent, and we need to support that.
Can you share a family success story?
Well, one was when I mentioned earlier to you was just this mom that had come to us from a domestic shelter and stayed with us for probably a good 3 years. So she had two young children. So both of them went through the program, and she had to finally say goodbye because they were going off to kindergarten, and just how much she appreciated, especially having come up from a domestic violence background, that she knew that she could be away from her children during the day and that they were safe. That meant so much to her. It gave her a sense of ease while she went through training and got a pretty good job, which she would still had when she was leaving us. That's just one story, but we see it all the time. I see children who come in who, maybe on the spectrum, and being able to get them services, making sure that you support the parent or the foster parent in navigating that, because that's frightening to parents. I mean, all parents, you know, if you tell them that there may be something wrong with their kid, which, you know, it's not, it's just a situation, and there's services to help that. But being able to be there for them, see families get back on their feet. For example, too, if a child comes to us under the foster care situation, when the foster placement, and they return to their parent, they can stay with us if they want to. So the parent does not have to remove them and take them somewhere else. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, depend on where they live. But it's like that child, we give that continuity. You came in because you were homeless and now you have housing. You can still stay until your child moves on to kindergarten. So
I think
that kind of stability is very important. And you see our children thriving and our parents learning to trust and knowing that this is a place that they can come to and won't be judged.
Well, that's such a perfect segue into my final question. And this question is how I close every episode, because I believe hope is what drives us. But, you know, this is hard work. You hear sad stories. What are the bright sides to you? What gives you hope?
Well, it's always the kids, right? I mean, to see them laughing and playing. And we have one child that is pretty nonverbal. He's almost three, very, very much so probably on the spectrum, you know, walks on his toes, isolates, doesn't even do parallel play. And he's been with us maybe 3-4 months, maybe a little longer. I lose track of time that way. But watching him now, where he's smiling, making eye contact, still doesn't play with children, but plays near them. And he's interested in some activities, where before he would just grab a leaf and just wave it in front of his face and mumble, you know, make sounds and then go to a corner. And I he's assigned to a really sweet teacher. She's really good at her job. And in our training, she's just like, I'm not reaching him. I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm failing him. And I was like, our job is just to continue to be there. He will come around when he's ready. You know, it just continue to ask questions, continue to have a conversation. I said, we do that with babies and we don't expect them to answer. But it's the same thing. Just continue to be open and it will work. You know, it's not going to solve his autism, but it's going to, you know, that we're still open to interacting with him, whatever level he's at. And he's, you know, has some services now. He's starting to point, still isn't really verbal, of course, but just watching that transition, I'll point it out. I'll walk through and see him in the play yard and I'll point out to her, said he's having joy right now. She goes, I know. And so just seeing that they can see the difference and we can see that difference. You know what you're doing is important.
That's really lovely. Thank you so much for the work you do in our communities and serving this sweet little vulnerable population. And thank you for showing so much grace in doing it. I can hear as you speak how much you love those kids and you love the work.
The kids are the best part, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Every time. And your work just makes the world a better place for all of us. So I thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And we're going to have to meet in person at some point.
I would love that. I would love that
and
very
we'll
much.
We'll have to have you come out and do a training.
Oh, that'd be great. Yes, absolutely.
Wonderful.
Thank you. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.